This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Hate List, written by Jennifer Brown, read by Kathleen McInerney, includes a bonus PDF of anti-bullying resources and an interview with the author.
For Scott, we'll show the world they were wrong and teach them all to sing along. Nickelback. Part 1. Chapter 1. From the Garvin County Sun Tribune, May 3, 2008. Reporter, Angela Dash. The scene in the Garvin High School cafeteria, known as the Commons, is being described as grim by investigators who are working to identify the victims of a shooting spree that erupted Friday morning. We have teams in there going over every detail, says Sergeant Pam Marone. We're getting a pretty clear picture of what went on yesterday morning. It hasn't been easy. Even some of our veteran officers got pretty shaken up when they walked in there. It's such a tragedy. The shooting, which began just as students were preparing for their first class, left at least six students dead and countless others wounded. Valerie Leftman, 16, was the last victim shot before Nick Leavell, the alleged shooter, reportedly turned the gun on himself. Hit in the thigh at close range, Leftman required extensive surgery to repair her wounds. Representatives at Garvin County General list her in critical condition. There was a lot of blood, an EMT told reporters on the scene. He must have hit her artery just right. She's very lucky, the ER nurse on duty confirmed. She's got a good chance of surviving, but we're being really careful, especially since so many people want to talk to her. Reports by witnesses at the scene of the shooting vary, some claiming Leftman was a victim, others saying she was a hero, still others alleging she was involved in a plan with Leavell to shoot and kill students whom they disliked. According to Jane Keller, a student who witnessed the shooting, the shot to Leftman appeared to be accidental.
It looked like she tripped and fell into him or something, but I couldn't tell for sure, Keller told reporters at the scene. All I know is, it was all over real quick after that, and when she fell on him, it gave some people a chance to run away.
But police are questioning whether the shot that took down Leftman was an accident or a double suicide gone awry. Early reports indicate that Leftman and Leavell had discussed suicide in some detail, and some sources close to the couple suggest they talked about homicide as well, leaving police wondering if there is more to the Garvin High shooting than originally thought.
They talked about death a lot, says Mason Markham, a close friend of both Leftman and Leavell. Nick talked about it more than Valerie, but yeah, Valerie talked about it too. We all thought they were just playing some game, but I guess it was for real. I can't believe they were serious. I mean, I was just talking to Nick like 3 hours ago, and he never said anything. Not about this.
Whether Leftman's wounds were intentional or accidental, there is little doubt in the minds of the police that Nick Leavell intended to commit suicide after massacring nearly half a dozen Garvin High students. Witnesses at the scene tell us that after he shot Leftman, he pointed the gun to his own head and pulled the trigger, says Marone. Leavell was pronounced dead at the scene.
It was a relief, says Keller. Some kids actually cheered, which I think is kind of wrong. But I guess I can understand why they did it. It was really scary.
Leftman's participation in the shooting is under investigation with Garvin County Police. Leftman's family could not be reached for comment, and police will only divulge that they're very interested in speaking with her at this time.
After I ignored the third snooze alarm, my mom started pounding on my door, trying to get me out of bed, just like any other morning. Only this morning wasn't just any other morning. This was the morning I was supposed to pick myself up and get on with my life. But I guess with moms, old habits die hard. If the snooze alarm doesn't do the trick, you start pounding and yelling, whatever kind of morning it is. Instead of just yelling at me, though, she started getting that scared, quavery sound in her voice that she'd had so often lately. The one that said she wasn't sure if I was just being difficult or if she should be ready to call 911. "Valerie," she kept pleading, "you have to get up now. The school is being very lenient letting you back in. Don't blow it your first day back." Like I would be happy about going back to school. About stepping back into those haunted halls. Into the commons, where the world as I knew it had crashed to an end last May. Like I hadn't been having nightmares about that place every single night and waking up sweaty, crying, totally relieved to be in my room again where things were safe. The school couldn't decide if I was hero or villain, and I guess I couldn't blame them. I was having a hard time deciding that myself. Was I the bad guy who set into motion the plan to mow down half my school, or the hero who sacrificed herself to end the killing? Some days, I felt like both. Some days, I felt like neither. It was all so complicated. The school board did try to hold some ceremony for me early in the summer, which was crazy. I didn't mean to be a hero. I wasn't even thinking when I jumped in between Nick and Jessica. It's certainly not like I thought, here's my chance to save the girl who used to laugh at me and call me Sister Death and get myself shot in the process. By all accounts, it was a heroic thing to do. But in my case, well, nobody was really sure. I refused to go to the ceremony. Told Mom my leg was hurting too much, and I needed some sleep. And besides, it was a stupid idea anyway. It was just like the school, I told her, to do something totally lame like that. I wouldn't go to something so dumb if you paid me, I said. But the truth was, I was scared of going to the ceremony. I was scared of facing all those people. Afraid they'd all believed everything they'd read about me in the newspaper and seen about me on TV. That I'd been a murderer. That I'd see it in their eyes. You should have committed suicide just like him. Even if they didn't say it out loud. Or worse, that they'd make me out to be someone brave and selfless, which would only make me feel more awful than I already did. Given that it was my boyfriend who killed all those kids. And apparently, I made him think I wanted them dead too. Not to mention I was the idiot who had no idea that the guy I loved was going to shoot up the school, even though he basically told me so, like, every day. But every time I opened my mouth to tell Mom those things, all that came out was, "It's so lame. I wouldn't go to something so dumb if you paid me." Guess old habits die hard for everyone. Mr. Angerson, the principal, ended up coming to our house that night instead. He sat at my kitchen table and talked to my mom about, I don't know, God, destiny, trauma, whatever. Waiting around, I'm sure, for me to come out of my room and smile and tell him how proud I was of my school and how I was more than happy to serve as a human sacrifice for Miss Perfect Jessica Campbell. Maybe he was waiting for me to apologize, too, which I would do if I could figure out how. But so far, I hadn't come up with words big enough for something this hard. When Mr. Angerson was in the kitchen waiting for me, I turned up my music and crawled deeper in my sheets and let him sit there. I never came out, not even when my mom started pounding on the door, begging in company voice for me to be polite and come downstairs. "Valerie, please," she hissed, opening the door a crack and poking her head into my room. I didn't answer. I pulled the sheets over my head instead. It's not that I didn't want to do it. It's that I just couldn't. But Mom would never understand that. The way she saw it, the more people who forgave me, the less I had to feel guilty about. The way I saw it, it was just the opposite. After a while, I saw headlights reflecting off my bedroom window. I sat up and looked into the driveway. Mr. Angerson was pulling away. A few minutes later, Mom knocked on my door again. "What?" I said. She opened the door and came in, looking all tentative, like a baby deer or something. Her face was all red and splotchy, and her nose was seriously plugged up. She was holding this dorky medal in her hand, along with a letter of thanks from the school district. "They don't blame you," she said. "They want you to know that. They want you to come back. They're very appreciative of what you did." She shoved the medal and letter into my hands. I glanced at the letter and noticed that only about 10 teachers had signed it. Noticed that, of course, Mr. Klein wasn't one of them. For about the millionth time since the shooting, I felt an enormous pang of guilt. Klein was exactly the kind of teacher who would have signed that letter, but he couldn't, because he was dead. We stared at each other for a minute. I knew my mom was looking for some sort of gratitude from me, some sense that if the school was moving on, maybe I could too. Maybe we all could. Yeah, Mom, I said. I handed the medal and letter back to her. That's, great. I tried to muster up a smile to reassure her, but found that I couldn't do it. What if I didn't want to move on just yet? What if that medal reminded me that the guy I'd trusted most in this world shot people, shot me, shot himself? Why couldn't she see that accepting the school's thanks in that light was painful to me? Like, gratitude would be the only possible emotion I could feel now. Gratitude that I'd lived. Gratitude that I'd been forgiven. Gratitude that they recognized that I'd saved the lives of other Garvin students. The truth was, most days I couldn't feel grateful, no matter how hard I tried. Most days I couldn't even pinpoint how I felt. Sometimes sad, sometimes relieved, sometimes confused, sometimes misunderstood, and a lot of times angry. And what's worse, I didn't know who I was angry at the most, myself, Nick, my parents, the school, the whole world. And then there was the anger that felt the worst of all. Anger at the students who died. "Val," she said, her eyes pleading. "No, really," I said. "It's cool. I'm just really tired, is all, Mom. Really. My leg." I pushed my head deeper into my pillow and folded myself into the blankets again. Mom bowed her head and left the room, stooped. I knew she would try to get Dr. Healer all worked up over my reaction at our next visit. I could imagine him sitting in his chair.
"So, Val, we probably should talk about that medal."
I know Mom later put the medal and letter away in a keepsake box with all the other kid junk she'd collected over the years. Kindergarten artwork, seventh grade report cards, a letter from the school thanking me for stopping a school shooting. To Mom, somehow all those things would fit together. That's Mom's way of showing her stubborn hope. Her hope that someday I'll be fine again. Although she probably can't remember the last time I was fine. Come to think of it, neither can I. Was it before the shooting? Before Jeremy walked into Nick's life? Before Dad and Mom started hating each other? And I started searching for someone, something to take me away from the unhappiness? Way back when I had braces and wore pastel-colored sweaters and listened to Top 40 and thought life would be easy? The snooze alarm sounded again and I pawed at it, accidentally knocking the clock to the floor. "Valerie, come on!" she yelled. I imagined she had the cordless in her hand by now, her finger poised over the 9. "School starts in an hour. Wake up!" I curled around my pillow and stared at the horses printed on my wallpaper. Ever since I was a little kid, every time I got into trouble, I'd lie on my bed and stare at those horses and imagine myself hopping on one of them and riding away. Just riding, 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 my hair swimming out behind me, my horse never getting tired or hungry, never finding another soul on earth, just open possibility ahead of me into eternity. Now the horses just looked like crappy kids' wallpaper art. They didn't take me anywhere. They couldn't. Now I knew they never could, which I thought was so sad. like my whole life was all a big, dumb dream. I heard clicking against the doorknob and groaned. Of course, the key. At some point, Dr. Healer, usually totally on my side, gave my mom permission to use a key and come into my room whenever she pleased. Just in case, you know, as a precaution, you know. There was that whole suicide issue, you know. So now, anytime I didn't answer her knock, she'd just come right in anyway, the cordless in her hand, just in case she walked in and I was lying in a pool of razor blades and blood on my daisy-shaped throw rug. I watched as the doorknob turned. Nothing I could do about it but watch from my pillow. She crept in. I was right. The cordless was in her hand. "Good, you're awake," she said. She smiled and bustled over to the window. She reached up and pulled the Venetian blinds open. I squinted against the early morning sunlight. "You're in a suit," I said, shading my eyes with my forearm. She reached down with her free hand and smoothed the camel-colored skirt around her thighs. It was tentative, like it was the first time she'd ever dressed up before. For a minute, she looked as insecure as I was, which made me feel sad for her. "Yeah," she said, using the same hand to pat the back of her hair. "I figured since you were going back to school, I should, you know, start trying to get back full time at the office." I pulled myself to a sitting position. My head felt sort of flat in the back from lying down so long, and my leg twinged a little. I absently rubbed the dent in my thigh under the sheets. "On my first day back?" She stumbled over to me, high-stepping over a pile of dirty laundry in her camel-colored high heels. "Well, yeah, it's been a few months. Dr. Healer thinks it's fine for me to go back, and I'll be there to pick you up after school." She sat on the side of my bed and stroked my hair. "You'll be fine." "How can you be so sure?" I asked. "How do you know I'll be all right? You can't know. I wasn't okay last May, and you didn't know that." I pulled myself out of bed. My chest felt tight, and I wasn't sure I wasn't going to cry. She sat, gripping the cordless in front of her. "I just know, Valerie. That day won't ever happen again, honey. Nix, he's gone. Now try not to get all upset." Too late. I was already upset. The longer she sat on the side of my bed and stroked my hair the way she used to do when I was little, and I smelled the perfume that I thought of as her work perfume, the more real it was. I was going back to school. "We all agreed that this was best, Valerie, remember?" she said. "Sitting in Dr. Healer's office, we decided that running away was not a good option for our family. You agreed. You said that you didn't want Frankie to have to suffer because of what happened. And your dad has his firm. To leave that and start all over again would be so tough for us financially." She shrugged, shaking her head. "Mom," I said. But I couldn't think of a great argument. She was right. I'd been the one saying that Frankie shouldn't have to leave his friends. That just because he was my little brother didn't mean he should have to change towns, change schools. That Dad, whose jaw tightened angrily every time someone brought up the possibility of our family having to move to a new town, shouldn't have to build a new law firm after working so hard to build his. That I shouldn't have to be stuck in my house with a tutor, or worse, to switch to a new school my senior year. That I'd be damned if I'd slink away like a criminal when I'd done nothing wrong. "It's not like everybody in the whole world doesn't know who I am anyway," I'd said, running my fingertips along the arm of Dr. Healer's couch. "It's not like I could find a school where nobody has heard of me. Can you imagine how much of an outcast I'd be at a new school? At least at Garvin, I know what to expect. Plus, if I ran away from Garvin, everyone there would be even more sure I was guilty."
"It'll be tough," Dr. Healer had warned. "You're going to have to face a lot of dragons."
I shrugged. "What else is new? I can handle them."
"Are you sure?"
Dr. Healer had asked, his eyes narrowed at me skeptically. I'd nodded. It's not fair that I should have to leave. I can do this. If it's terrible, I can always transfer at the end of the semester. But I'll make it. I'm not afraid. But that was back when summer stretched in front of us, impossibly long. Back when going back was just an idea, not a reality. As an idea, I still believed in it. I wasn't guilty of anything except loving Nick and hating the people who tormented us. And there was no way I'd slither away and hide from the people who believed I was guilty of something else. But now that it came down to putting my idea to practice, I wasn't just afraid. I was terrified. "You had all summer to change your mind," Mom said, still sitting on my bed. I snapped my mouth shut and turned toward my dresser. I grabbed a pair of clean underwear and a bra, then scavenged the floor for some jeans and a t-shirt. "Fine, I'll get ready," I said. I can't say that she smiled just then. She did something that was kind of like a smile, only it looked a little painful. She took a couple false starts toward the door, and then apparently decided it was a good decision and headed for it completely, gripping the phone in both hands. I wondered if she'd accidentally take the phone to work with her, thumb still poised over the 9. "Good. I'll wait for you downstairs." I dressed, pulling on the wrinkled jeans and t-shirt haphazardly, not even caring what they looked like. It's not like dressing well was going to make me feel any better or any less conspicuous. I hobbled into the bathroom and ran a brush through my hair, which hadn't been washed in about 4 days. I didn't bother with makeup either. Didn't really even know where it was. It's not like I'd been to a lot of cotillions over the summer. For most of that time, I couldn't even walk. I slipped on a pair of canvas shoes and grabbed my backpack, a new one that Mom had bought a few days ago and that had sat empty in the very place she'd left it, until she finally came in and stuffed it with supplies herself. The old backpack, the bloody one. Well, that probably ended up in the garbage, along with Nick's flogging Molly t-shirt, which she'd found in my closet and thrown away while I was stuck in the hospital. I cried and called her a bitch when I got home and saw that the shirt was missing. She totally didn't get it. That shirt didn't belong to Nick, the murderer. It belonged to Nick, the guy who surprised me with flogging Molly tickets when they came to the closet. Nick, the guy who let me climb up on his shoulders while they sang Factory Girls. Nick, the guy who had the idea that we would pool our money to buy one t-shirt and share it. Nick, the guy who wore the shirt home and then took it off and gave it to me, and then never asked for it back. She claimed that throwing the shirt away was advice from Dr. Healer, too, but I didn't believe it. Sometimes I had a feeling she just blamed all her ideas on him, so I'd roll with it. Dr. Healer would understand that Nick the murderer didn't own that shirt. I didn't even know who Nick the murderer was. Dr. Healer understood that. All dressed, I was struck with the sensation of being too nervous to go through with it. My legs felt almost too weak to take me out the door, and a light coating of sweat covered the back of my neck. I couldn't go. I couldn't face those people, those places. I just wasn't strong enough. With shaky hands, I fumbled my cell phone out of my pocket and dialed Dr. Healer's cell phone number. He answered on the first ring. "Sorry to bother you," I said, sinking down onto my bed.
"No, I told you to call. Remember? I was waiting for it."
"I don't think I can do this," I said. "I'm not ready. I don't think I'll ever be ready. I think it was a bad idea to—"
"Val, stop,"
he interrupted.
"You can do this. You're ready. We've talked this through. It's going to be tough, but you can handle it. You've handled a lot worse over the past several months, right? You're very strong."
Tears sprang to my eyes and I wiped them off with my thumb.
"Just concentrate on being in the moment," he said. "Don't read into things. See what's really there, okay? When you get home this afternoon, call me. I'll have Stephanie patch you through even if I'm in session, okay?"
"Okay.
And if you need to talk during the day—"
"I know. I can call."
And remember what we said? Even if you make it through only half the day, it's already a victory, right?
Mom's going back to work. Full day.
That's because she believes in you. But she'll come home if you need her. My prediction is you won't, though. And you know I'm always right.
There was a smile in his voice. I chuckled, sniffed, wiped my eyes again. Right. Whatever. I gotta go.
You're going to do great.
I hope so.
I know so. And remember what we said. You can always transfer after this semester if it doesn't work out. That's what, 75 days or so?
83, I said.
See? Piece of cake. You've got this. Call me later.
I will. I hung up and picked up my backpack. I started to walk out the door, but stopped. There was something missing. I reached under my top dresser drawer and fumbled around until I found it, tucked into the frame of the drawer, out of Mom's investigative reach. I pulled it out and looked at it for about the millionth time. It was a photo of Nick and me at Blue Lake on the last day of school, sophomore year. He was holding a beer, and I was laughing so hard I swear you could see my tonsils in the picture. And we were sitting on a giant rock right next to the lake. I think it was Mason who took the picture. I couldn't for the life of me remember what was so funny, no matter how many nights I stayed awake trying to drum it up. We looked so happy. And we were. No matter what the emails and the suicide notes and the hate list said, we were happy. I touched the laughing, still shot of Nick's face with my finger. I could still hear his voice, loud and clear, still hear him asking me out in his serious Nick way, at once bold and angry and romantic and shy.
Val,
he had said, pulling himself off the rock and bending to pick up his beer bottle. He picked up a flat rock with his free hand and took a few steps forward and skipped it across the lake. It skipped once, twice, three times before it dove into the water and stayed. Stacy laughed from somewhere nearby in the woods. Deuce laughed just after her. It was getting on to nightfall and a frog started croaking somewhere to my left.
Do you ever think about just leaving it all behind?
I pulled my heels up against the rock and grabbed my knees. I thought about Mom and Dad's fight the night before, about Mom's voice drifting up the stairs from the living room, the words unclear, but the tone venomous. About Dad leaving the house around midnight, the door shutting softly behind him.
You mean like run away?
Definitely. Nick was silent for a long time. He picked up another rock and slung it across the lake. It skipped twice and fell.
Sure,
he said.
Or, you know, like driving off a cliff and never looking back.
I stared at the setting sun and thought about it. Yeah, I said. Everybody does. Totally Thelma and Louise. He turned and kind of laughed, then swigged the last of his beer and dropped the bottle to the ground.
Never saw it,
he said. Then,
remember when we read Romeo and Juliet in freshman English last year?
Yeah. He leaned over me.
You think we could be like them?
I crinkled my nose. I don't know. I guess. Sure. He turned again and stared out into the lake.
Yeah, we could. We really could. We think alike.
I stood up and brushed the backs of my thighs, which felt dimply from the texture of the rock we'd been sitting on. Are you asking me out? He turned, lurched toward me, and grabbed me around the waist. He picked me up until my feet were dangling above the ground, and I couldn't help it. I let out a squeal that turned into a giggle. He kissed me, and my body felt so electric up against his, even my toes tingled. It seemed like forever that I'd been waiting for him to do this.
Would you say no if I did?
He asked. Hell no, Romeo, I said. I kissed him back.
Then I guess I am, Juliet,
he'd said. And I swear as I touched his face in the photo, I could hear it again, could feel him in the room with me. even though in May he became a monster in the eyes of the world. In my eyes, he was still that guy holding me above the ground, kissing me, and calling me Juliet. I stuffed the photo into my back pocket. 83 and counting, I said aloud, taking a deep breath and heading downstairs. May 2nd, 2008, 6:32 a.m. See you in the Commons? My cell phone chirped and I grabbed it before Mom or Frankie or, God forbid, Dad heard it. It was still early and dim outside. One of those tough mornings to wake up to. Summer break was right around the corner, which meant 3 months of sleeping in and not having to put up with Garvin High. Not that I hated school or anything, but Christy Bruder was like always giving me trouble on the bus, and I had a D in science because of a quiz I forgot to study for. And finals were going to be a killer this year. Nick had been a little quiet lately. In fact, he hadn't shown up at school for 2 days and had texted me all day long asking about the shits in homeroom or the fat bitches in PE or that scab McNeil. He'd been hanging around with this guy Jeremy for the last month, and every day he seemed to pull further and further away from me. I was afraid he was going to break up with me, so I just played along like it was no big deal that we hardly ever saw each other anymore. I didn't want to push him. He'd been so volatile lately, and I didn't want to start a fight. I didn't ask him what he was doing on those days he didn't show up, and instead just texted him back that the shits in bio need to be dunked in formaldehyde, and that I hate those bitches, and that McNeil is lucky I don't have a gun. That last one would really come back to bite me later. Really, they all would. But that last one would make me vomit every time I thought about it for a long time. And it would inspire a 3-hour conversation between me and Detective Panzella. And it would make my dad forever look at me differently, like I was some sort of monster deep down, and he could see it. Jeremy was this older guy, like 21 or something, who'd graduated from Garvin a few years ago. He didn't go to college. He didn't have a job. From what I could tell, all Jeremy did was beat up his girlfriend and sit around smoking pot and watching cartoons all day. Until he met Nick, and then he stopped watching the cartoons and started smoking his dope with Nick, and only beat up his girlfriend on nights when he wasn't in Nick's garage, playing drums, too stoned to remember she existed. On the rare occasions that I'd been over there when Jeremy was there, Nick was a totally different guy. Someone I didn't even recognize, really. For a long time, I thought maybe I just never knew Nick at all. Maybe when Nick and I were watching TV in his basement, or dunking each other at the pool and laughing, I was totally not seeing the real Nick. Like, the real Nick was the one that showed up when Jeremy came over. That hard-eyed, selfish Nick. I'd heard of women who were completely blind and ignored all these signs that their man was some sort of pervert or monster, but no way could you convince me I was one of them. When Jeremy wasn't around, when it was just me and Nick, and I looked in Nick's eyes, I knew what I saw, and it was good. He was good. He had a sick sense of humor sometimes. We all did. But no way did we mean it. So sometimes it makes sense to me that maybe it was Jeremy who put those ideas about shooting up the school in Nick's head. Not me. Jeremy. He's the bad guy. He's the one. I picked up the cell and fumbled it down under the covers, where I had been slowly waking up to the idea that I had to get through another school day. Lil?
Baby.
Nick's voice was thin, almost wired sounding. Although, at the time, I just figured that was because it was so early, and Nick hardly ever got up early anymore. Hey, I whispered. Going to school today for a change? He chuckled. Sounded really happy.
Yeah, Jeremy's gonna drive me.
I pulled myself to a sitting position. Cool. Stacy was asking about you yesterday. Said she saw you and Jeremy driving out toward Blue Lake.
I let the unspoken question hang in the air.
Yeah.
I heard the flick of his lighter and the crackle of a cigarette filter. He exhaled.
We had some stuff to do out there.
Like? He didn't answer. Just the sound of the filter burning and his steady exhale. Disappointment washed over me. He wasn't going to tell me. I hated the way he was acting. He'd never kept secrets from me before. We'd always talked about everything. Even the hard stuff, like our parents' marriages and the names kids called us at school. And how sometimes we felt like nothing. Like less than nothing. I almost pressed him, told him I wanted to know, I deserved to know. But decided to change the subject instead. If I was finally going to get to see him, I didn't want to waste that time fighting with him. Hey, I've got some names for the list, I said.
Who?
I rubbed the corners of my eyes with my fingertips. People who say sorry after everything. Fast food commercials. And Jessica Campbell. Jeremy, I almost added, but thought better of it.
That skinny blonde chick that goes out with Jake Deal?
Uh-huh, but Jake's okay. I mean, a little jockish, but he's no way as annoying as her. Yesterday in health, I was totally just spacing out, and I guess I was looking in her direction. So all of a sudden, she looks at me and goes, "What are you looking at, Sister Death?" And she had this scowl on her face, and she rolls her eyes and goes, "Hello, mind your own business." And I was all, "Trust me, I don't give a shit about what you were saying anyway." And she was like, "Don't you have a funeral to go to?" And then her stupid friend started laughing like she was some sort of stand-up comedian or something. She's such a bitch.
Yeah, you're right.
He coughed. I heard a rattle of papers being turned and could imagine Nick sitting on his mattress writing in the red spiral notebook we shared.
All those blonde chicks should just disappear.
At the time, I'd laughed. It was funny. I agreed with him. At least, I said I did. And, okay, I really thought I did. I didn't feel like a horrible person, but I laughed because to me, they were the horrible people. They deserved it. Yeah, they should be run over by their parents' beamers, I said.
I put that showgirl on the list, too.
Good one. She won't shut up about making varsity. I don't know what her problem is.
Yeah, well...
We sat in silence for a minute. I don't know what Nick was thinking. At the time, I took his silence to be some sort of unspoken agreement with me, like we were speaking at the same time in some wavelength that had no breath. But now I know that's just one of those inferences Dr. Healer was always telling me about. People do it all the time, assume that they know what's going on in someone else's head. That's impossible. And to think it's possible. Is a mistake, a really big mistake, a life-ruining one if you're not careful. I heard some mumbling in the background.
Gotta go,
Nick said.
We gotta take Jeremy's kid to daycare. His girlfriend's being a pain in the ass about it. See you in the commons?
Sure. I'll have Stacy save us a seat.
Cool.
Love you.
You too, baby.
I hung up, smiling. Maybe whatever was bugging him was resolved. Maybe he was getting sick of Jeremy and Jeremy's kid and Jeremy's cartoons and Jeremy's pot. Maybe I could talk him into skipping lunch and walking with me across the highway to Casey's for a sandwich. Just the two of us, like old times. Us sitting on the concrete median, picking onions off our sandwiches, and asking each other music trivia questions, our shoulders butted up against one another, our feet swinging. I jumped in the shower without bothering to turn on the light and stood, enveloped by the steam in the dark, hoping maybe Nick would bring me something special today. He was pretty good at that, showing up at school with a rose he'd picked up at the gas station or sliding a candy bar into my locker between classes, slipping a note into my notebook when I wasn't looking. When he wanted to, Nick had a hell of a romantic side. I got out of the shower and dried off. I took extra time on my hair and eyeliner and wore a torn black denim miniskirt with my favorite pair of striped black and white tights with the hole in the knee. I stuffed my feet into socks and a pair of canvas shoes and grabbed my backpack. My little brother, Frankie, was eating cereal at the kitchen table. His hair was spiked, and he looked like one of those kids in Pop-Tart commercials, perfectly coiffed skater types. Frankie was 14 and totally full of himself. He thought he was some sort of fashion guru and was always dressed so stylishly he looked like he'd just stepped out of a catalog. We were close, despite the fact that we tended to hang out with totally different crowds, and we had completely different definitions of what was cool. He could be annoying at times, but most of the time, he was a pretty good little brother. He had his American history textbook open on the table next to him, and was frantically scribbling on a piece of notebook paper, stopping only to shovel a bite of cereal into his mouth every so often. "Shooting a hair gel commercial today?" I asked, bumping into his chair with my hip on the way past.
"What?"
he said, running the palm of his hand over the spikes of his hair.
"The ladies love it."
I rolled my eyes, smiling. "I'll bet. Dad leave yet?" He took another bite of cereal and went back to writing.
"Yeah," he said, around the food in his mouth. "He left a few minutes ago."
I grabbed a waffle out of the freezer and popped it into the toaster.
"I see you were too busy with the ladies to do your homework last night," I teased, leaning over him to read what he was writing. "What did the women in the Civil War era think of excess hair gel, exactly?" "Give me a break," he said, bumping me with his elbow. "I was talking to Tina until midnight. I gotta get this done. Mom'll freak if I get another C in history. She'll take my cell phone away again."
"Okay, okay," I said. "I'll leave you alone. Far be it from me to stand between you and Tina's riveting phone romance." The waffle popped up out of the toaster and I grabbed it. I took a bite of it, plain. "Speaking of Mom, is she driving you again today?" He nodded. Mom drove Frankie to school every day, dropping him off on her way to work. It gave him a few extra minutes in the morning, which I guess would be nice. But since it would require me to sit within 3 feet of my mom and thus spend every morning hearing how my hair looks atrocious and my skirt is too short and why does a beautiful girl like you want to ruin her looks with all that makeup and hair dye, I preferred to stand on the curb and wait for the bus full of jocks to come get me. And that's saying something. I looked at the clock on the stove. The bus would be coming any minute. I shouldered my backpack and took another bite of my waffle. "I'm out of here," I said, heading for the door. "Good luck with your homework."
"See ya,"
he called to my back as I stepped out on the front porch, closing the door behind me. The air felt crisper than usual. Felt like winter was on the verge of rushing in on us rather than spring. Like right now, the day was the warmest it was going to get.
Chapter 2. From the Garvin County Sun Tribune, May 3, 2008. Reporter Angela Dash. Christy Bruder, 16. Bruder, captain of the Garvin High softball team, was the first victim and appeared to be a direct target.
"He bumped her in the shoulder," says Amy Bruder, the victim's mother. "And some of the girls who were there told us that when Christy turned around, he said, 'You've been on the list for a really long time.' She said, 'What list?' And then he shot her."
Bruder, who was shot in the stomach, is described by doctors as damned lucky to be alive. Investigation confirmed that, indeed, Bruder's name was the first of hundreds on the now infamous hate list, a red spiral notebook confiscated from Nick Leavell's home just hours after the shooting.
"Are you nervous?" I picked at the rubber that was peeling off the sole of my shoe and shrugged. There were so many emotions running through me, I thought I might go screaming down the street. But for some reason, all I could muster was a shrug. Which, now that I think about it, was a good thing. Mom was watching me extra close this morning. Any wrong move, and she would run to Dr. Healer and blow it all out of proportion as usual, and then we'd have the conversation again. Dr. Healer and I had had the conversation at least once a week since May. It always went something like this. He would ask,
"Are you safe?"
"I'm not going to kill myself if you're asking that," I'd answer.
"I am,"
he'd say. "Well, I'm not going to do it. She's just crazy," I'd answer.
"She's just worried about you,"
he'd say. And then we'd, thankfully, move on to something else. But then I'd get home later and climb into bed and start thinking about it, about the suicide stuff. Was I safe? Was there really a time I might have been suicidal and I didn't even know it? And then I'd spend about an hour, my room darkening around me, wondering what the hell happened to make me so unsure of who I even was. Because who you are is supposed to be the easiest question in the world to answer, right? Only for me, it hadn't been easy for a very long time. Maybe it never was. Sometimes, in my world where parents hated one another and school was a battleground, it sucked to be me. Nick had been my escape, the one person who understood. It had felt good to be part of an us with the same thoughts, the same feelings, the same miseries. But now the other half of us was gone, and lying there in my shadowy room, I'd be struck with this realization that I had no clue how to be just me again. I'd roll over on my side and stare at the dark, shadowy horses dotting my wallpaper, and wish they would giddy up and take me away, the way I'd imagined them doing when I was a kid, so I wouldn't have to think about it anymore. Because not having a clue who you are hurts way too much. And one thing I did know for sure, I was tired of hurting. Mom reached across the front seat and patted my knee. "Well, if you get halfway through the day and need me, I'm just a phone call away, okay?" I didn't answer. The lump in my throat was too big. It seemed surreal that I was about to be walking in the same hallways with these kids who I knew so well, but who seemed like complete strangers. Kids like Alan Moon, who I'd seen look directly into a camera and say, "I hope they put Valerie away for life for what she did." And Carmen Chiaro, who was quoted in a magazine as saying, "I don't know why my name was even on that list. I didn't even know who Nick and Valerie were before that day." I could see her not knowing Nick. When he moved to Garvin freshman year, he was just a quiet, skinny kid with bad clothes and dirty hair. But Carmen and I had gone to elementary school together. She was totally lying when she said she didn't know me. And given that she was good friends with Mr. Quarterback Chris Summers all of sophomore year, and given that Chris Summers hated Nick and would take every chance he could to make Nick miserable, and given that all of Chris's buddies thought it was hilarious whenever he tormented Nick, I found it highly suspect that she didn't know Nick either. Would Alan and Carmen be there today? Would they be looking for me? Would they be hoping I wouldn't show? "And you know Dr. Healer's number," Mom said, patting my knee again. I nodded. "I know it." We turned down Oak Street. I could have driven this way in my sleep, right on Oak Street, left on Foundling Avenue, left on Starling, right into the parking lot. Garvin High, straight ahead. Can't miss it. Only this morning, it looked different to me. Never again would Garvin High have that exciting and intimidating look it held for me as a freshman. Never again would I equate it with mind-bending romance, with euphoria, laughter. A job well done. None of the things most people think of when they imagine their high schools. It was just another thing that Nick had stolen from me, from all of us, that day. He didn't just steal our innocence and sense of well-being. He had somehow managed to rob us of our memories as well. "You'll be fine," Mom said. I turned my head and looked out the window. Saw Delaney Peters walking down by the football field with her arm hooked through Sam Hall's. I had no idea they were together. And suddenly, I felt as if I'd missed a lifetime rather than just a summer. Had things been normal, I'd have spent the summer at the lake or at the bowling alley or gas station or fast food places, picking up gossip, learning about new romances. Instead, I was holed up in my bedroom, afraid and sick to my stomach at the thought of so much as going to the grocery store with my mom. Dr. Healer feels strongly that you'll be able to handle today with flying colors.
I know, I said. I leaned forward, and my stomach started to tighten. Stacy and Deuce were sitting on the bleachers like always, along with Mason, David, Liz, and Rebecca. Normally, I would be sitting there with them, and with Nick, comparing schedules, griping about who we got for homeroom, talking about being at some wild party together. My hands started to sweat. Stacy was laughing at something Deuce had said, and I felt more like an outsider than ever. We angled into the driveway, and right away I noticed two police cruisers parked next to the school. I must have made a noise or had a look, because Mom said, "It's just standard now. Security. Because, well, you know, they don't want any copycats. It makes you safer, Valerie." Mom pulled up in the drop-off zone and stopped. Her hands fell away from the steering wheel, and she looked at me. I tried not to notice that the corners of her mouth were twitching, and she was absently picking at a hangnail on her thumb. I put on a wobbly smile for her. "I'll see you right here at 2:50, she said. "I'll be waiting for you." "I'll be fine," I said in a tiny voice. I pulled on the door handle. My hands didn't seem to have enough strength to make it budge, but eventually it did, which disappointed me because it meant I was going to have to get out. "Maybe tomorrow you'll wear a little lipstick or something," Mom said as I pulled myself out of the car. What a strange thing to say, I thought. But I tucked my lips in against each other anyway, out of habit. I shut the door and gave Mom a half wave. She waved back, searching me with her eyes until the car behind her honked and she pulled away. For a minute, I was rooted to my spot on the sidewalk, unsure whether or not I could walk into the building. My thigh ached and my head was buzzing. But everyone around me seemed totally normal. A couple sophomores walked past me, talking excitedly about homecoming. One girl giggled as her boyfriend poked her in the side with his finger. Teachers stood around on the sidewalk, griping at kids to get to class. All things I remembered from the last time I was here. Strange. I started walking, but a voice behind me made me stop dead in my tracks. "No way!" It seemed like someone hit the mute button on the world just then. I turned and looked. Stacy and Deuce were standing there, holding hands. Stacy's mouth hanging open, Deuce's screwed into a tidy little knot. "Val?" Stacy asked, not as if she didn't believe it was me, but as if she didn't believe it was me here. "Hey," I said. David came around Stacy and hugged me. His hug was stiff, and he let go right away, stepping back in line with the rest of the gang, dropping his eyes to the ground in front of him. "I didn't know you were coming back today," Stacy said. Her eyes darted just briefly to the side, assessing Deuce's face, and I could instantly see her begin to mold herself into a copy of him. Her grin took on a superior slant that was really awkward on her face. I shrugged. Stacy and I had been friends since pretty much forever. We wore the same size, liked the same movies, dressed in the same clothes, told the same lies. There were stretches every summer when we were almost inseparable. But there was one big difference between Stacy and me. Stacy had no enemies, probably because she was so eager to please all the time. She was completely moldable. You just told her who she was, and she became it, just like that. She definitely wasn't one of the popular kids, but she wasn't one of the losers like me either. She had always sort of walked this line in between, totally under the radar. After the incident, as my dad likes to call it, Stacy came to visit me twice, once in the hospital before I was speaking to anyone, once at home after I was released, and I had Frankie tell her I was asleep. She never really tried to make contact again, and neither did I. I think maybe there was a part of me that felt like I didn't deserve friends anymore, like she deserved a better friend than me.
In a way, I felt sorry for her. I could almost see it in her face, her desire to go back to where we were before the shooting, the guilt she felt over holding me at arm's length. But I could also see how acutely aware she was of how being friends with me now made her look. If I was guilty by virtue of loving Nick, would she be guilty by virtue of loving me? Being my friend would be a tough risk to take, social suicide for anyone at Garvin, and Stacy would no way be strong enough to take that risk.
Does your leg hurt? She asked.
Sometimes, I said, looking down at it. At least I don't have to take PE, but I'll probably never get to class on time with this thing.
Been to Nick's grave?
Deuce asked. I looked at him sharply. He was staring at me with hard contempt in his eyes.
Been to anyone's grave?
Stacy elbowed him. Leave her alone. It's her first day back, she said, but without much conviction.
Yeah, come on, David mumbled. Glad you're okay, Val. Who do you have for math?
Deuce interrupted.
What? She can walk? How come she never went to nobody's grave? I mean, if I was the one writing down all these names of people I wanted dead, I'd at least go to their graves.
I didn't want anyone to die, I practically whispered. Deuce gave me one of those raised eyebrow looks. He was your best friend too, you know. There was silence between us, and I began to notice that all around me were curious onlookers. Only they weren't curious about the confrontation. They were curious about me, as if they'd all of a sudden realized who I was. They walked past me slowly on all sides, whispering to one another, staring at me. Stacy had begun to notice, too. She shifted a little, and then looked past me.
I gotta get to class, she said. Glad you're back, Val.
She was already walking past me, David and Mason and the others trailing behind her. Deuce moved last, shouldering past me, murmuring,
Yeah, it's real great.
I stood on the sidewalk, feeling marooned with this strange tide of kids moving around me, shoving me backward and forward with their motion, but never breaking me loose into the sea itself. I wondered if I could stand in this very spot until Mom came back at 2:50. A hand fell on my shoulder.
Why don't you come with me?
A voice said in my ear. I turned and found myself looking into the face of Mrs. Tate, the guidance counselor. She wrapped her arm around my shoulders and pulled me along, the two of us heading boldly through the waves of kids around us, leaving whispers in our wake.
It's good to see you here today, Mrs. Tate said. I'm sure you're a little apprehensive about it, no?
A little, I said. But I couldn't say more because she was pulling me along so fast it was all I could do to concentrate on walking. We broke into the vestibule before the panic in my torso could even well up, and somehow I felt cheated, like I should at least have the right to panic about entering my school again if that's what I wanted. The hallway was a bustle of motion. A police officer stood at the door, waving a wand over students' backpacks and jackets. Mrs. Tate waved her hand at one of them and ushered me past him without stopping. It seemed a little sparse in the hallways, like a lot of kids were missing, but otherwise it was like nothing had changed. Kids were talking, squealing, shoes were scuffling on shiny tile, the walls echoing with the wham, wham, wham of lockers slamming in the hallways beyond my eyes' reach. Mrs. Tate and I walked through the hall with purpose, then rounded the corner to the commons. This time, the panic rose so quickly it made it to my throat before Tate could pull me into the large room. She must have sensed my fear, because she squeezed my shoulders harder and pressed on more quickly. The Commons, once the place to hang out in the mornings, ordinarily packed shoulder to shoulder, was empty, save for the clusters of empty tables and chairs. At the far end, the end where Christy Bruder had fallen, someone had installed a bulletin board. Across the top were construction paper cut-out letters reading, We Will Remember, and the board was papered with notes, cards, ribbons, photos, banners, flowers. A couple girls, I couldn't tell who from this distance, were pinning a note and photograph to the bulletin board. We would have banned congregating in the commons in the mornings if we'd had to,
Mrs. Tate said, as if she could tell what I was thinking, just out of safety concerns. But it looks like nobody wants to hang out here anymore anyway. Now we only use the commons for lunch shifts. We walked straight through the commons. I tried to ignore my imagination, which had my feet sliding in sticky blood across the floor. I tried to focus on the sound of Mrs. Tate's shoes clacking against the tile, trying to remind myself of all the things about breathing and focusing that Dr. Healer had spent so much time coaching me on. At the moment, I couldn't remember a single one. We passed through the doorway at the other end of the commons, where the administration offices were. Technically, this was the front of the building. More officers were searching backpacks and passing metal detector wands over kids' clothes. All this security is going to make our mornings get off to a slow start, I'm afraid, Mrs. Tate sighed. But of course, this way we'll all feel safer. She whisked me past the officers and into the administrative offices. The secretaries looked on with polite smiles, but didn't say a word. I kept my face tilted to the floor and followed Mrs. Tate into her office. I hoped she'd let me stay there a long time. Mrs. Tate's office was the opposite of Dr. Healer's. Where Dr. Healer's was tidy and lined with rows and rows of reference books, Mrs. Tate's was a haphazard conglomeration of paperwork and educational tools, like it was part guidance office, part supply closet. There were books stacked on just about every flat surface, and photos of Mrs. Tate's kids and dogs everywhere. Most kids came to Mrs. Tate to either complain about a teacher or look through a college catalog, and that was pretty much it. If Mrs. Tate had gone to college hoping to counsel scads of troubled teenagers, she was probably pretty disappointed, if there can be such a thing as disappointment about not having enough troubled people in your life. She motioned for me to sit in a chair with a torn vinyl seat, and she edged herself around a small file cabinet and sat in the chair behind her desk, dwarfed by stacks of papers and post-it notes in front of her. She leaned forward over the mess and folded her hands right in the middle of an old fast food wrapper. "I was watching for you this morning," she said. "I'm glad you came back to school. Shows guts." "I'm giving it a try," I mumbled, rubbing my thigh absently. "I can't make any promises I'll stay."
83 and counting, I repeated in my head.
"Well, I hope you do. You're a good student," she said. "Ah!" she yelped, holding up one finger. She leaned to the side and pulled open a drawer of the file cabinet next to her desk. A framed photo of a black-and-white cat pawing at something wobbled as the drawer moved, and I imagined her, several times a day, having to write the photo after it fell. She pulled a brown file folder out and opened it on the desk in front of her, leaving the file drawer hanging ajar.
"That reminds me. College. Yes, you were considering..."
She flipped through a few pages. "Kansas State, if I remember correctly." She kept flipping, then ran her finger down a page and said, "Yep, right here, Kansas State and Northwest Missouri State." She closed the folder and smiled. "I got the program requirements from each of them just last week. It's a little late to be just starting this process, but it shouldn't be a problem. Well, you'll probably have to account for some things on your permanent record, but..."
"Really? You were never charged with... well, you know what I mean."
I nodded. I knew what she meant. Not that it needed to be on my permanent record, because I pretty much couldn't think of anyone in the country who hadn't heard of me by now. I was like best friends with the world, or maybe worst enemies. "I changed my mind," I said.
"Oh, a different school? Shouldn't be a problem. With your grades..."
"No, I mean, I'm not going to college." Mrs. Tate leaned forward, resting her hand on the wrapper again. She was frowning at me.
"Not going?"
"Right. I don't want to anymore." She spoke softly.
"Listen, Valerie, I know you blame yourself for what happened. I know you think you're just like him, but you're not."
I sat up straighter and tried to smile confidently. This was not a conversation I wanted to get into today, of all days.
Really, Mrs. Tate, you don't have to say this, I said. I touched my back pocket with the picture of Nick and me at Blue Lake in it for reassurance. I mean, I'm okay and everything. Mrs. Tate held up a hand and looked me straight in the eye. I spent more time with Nick than with my own son most days, she said. He was such a searcher, always so angry. He was one of those kids who was just going to struggle through life. He was so consumed with hate, ruled by it, really. No, I wanted to shout at her. No, he wasn't. Nick was good. I saw it. I was struck with a memory of the night Nick had shown up at my house unexpectedly, just as Mom and Dad began to rev up for their usual after-dinner bitch fest. I could feel it coming. Mom slamming plates into the dishwasher, mumbling under her breath, and Dad pacing the floor between the living room and the kitchen, eyeing Mom and shaking his head. The tension was building, and I'd begun to get that tired feeling I'd had so often lately, wishing I could just go to bed and wake up in a different house, a different life. Frankie had already disappeared into his room, and I wondered if he got that tired feeling too. I was just climbing the stairs to my bedroom when the doorbell rang. I could see Nick through the window next to the door, shifting his weight from foot to foot. I'll get it, I hollered to my parents as I ran back down the stairs, but the argument had already started, and they didn't notice. Hey, I'd said, stepping out on the front porch. What's up?
Hey,
he said back. He'd held out a CD.
I brought this,
he said.
I burned it for you this afternoon. It's all the songs that make me think about you.
That's so sweet, I said, reading the back of the case, where he'd carefully typed all of the titles and artists of the songs. I love it. On the other side of the door, we could hear Dad's voice getting closer.
You know, maybe I won't come home, Jenny. That's a great idea,
he was growling. Nick looked at the door, and I could swear I saw embarrassment creep through his face. And something else. Pity, maybe? Fear? Maybe that same weariness I felt?
Wanna get out of here?
He asked, shoving his hands into his pockets.
It doesn't sound too good in there. We can hang together for a while.
I nodded, opening the door a crack and dropping the CD on the table in the foyer. Nick reached out and grabbed my hand, leading me to the field behind my house. We found a clearing and sprawled on our backs in the grass, looking at the stars, talking about anything, everything.
You know why we get along so well, Val?
He asked after a while.
Because we think just alike. It's like we have the same brain. It's cool.
I stretched, wrapping my leg around his. Totally, I said. Screw our parents, screw their stupid fights, screw everybody. Who gives a shit about them?
Not me,
he said. He scratched his shoulder.
For a long time, I thought nobody would ever get me. But you really do.
Of course I do. I turned my head and kissed his shoulder. And you get me, too. It's kind of creepy the way we're so alike.
Creepy in a good way.
Yeah, in a good way. He turned to face me, propping himself up on an elbow.
It's good that we have each other, he said. It's like, you know, even if the whole world hates you, you still have someone to rely on. Just the two of you against the whole world. Just us.
At the time, my thoughts had been so consumed with Mom and Dad and their incessant arguing, I'd just assumed we were talking about them. Nick knew exactly what I was going through. He called his stepdad Charles, his step du jour, and talked about his mom's ever-changing love life as if it were some big joke. I'd had no idea he might have meant us against everyone. Yeah, just us, I'd answered. Just us. I looked at the carpet of Mrs. Tate's office, once again struck with the feeling that I never knew Nick at all. That all of that soulmate stuff we'd talked about was just bullshit. That when it comes to reading people, I'm an F student. I felt a lump in my throat. How indulgent was that? The school outcast cries over the memory of her boyfriend, the murderer. Even I would hate me. I swallowed and forced the lump to go down. Mrs. Tate had sat back in her chair, but was still talking.
Valerie, you had a future. You were choosing colleges. You were getting good grades.
Nick never had a future. Nick's future was this. A tear spilled over. I swallowed and swallowed, but it did no good. How did she know about Nick's future? You can't predict the future.
God, if I could have predicted what happened, I would have stopped it. I would have made it go away. But I didn't. I couldn't.
And I should have. That's what gets me. I should have. And now my future doesn't have college in it. My future is about being known around the world as the girl who hates everyone. That's what the newspapers called me. The girl who hates everyone.
I wanted to tell Tate all of these things. But it was all so complicated, and thinking about it made my leg throb and my heart ache.
I stood up and shrugged into my backpack. I wiped my cheeks with the backs of my hands.
I better get to class, I said. I don't want to be late on the first day.
I'll think about it. College, I mean. But, like I said, I can't make any promises, okay?
Mrs. Tate sighed and stood up. She pushed the file drawer in, but didn't move around the file cabinet.
Valerie, she said, then stopped and seemed to reconsider. Try to have a good day, okay?
I am glad you're back,
and I'll hang on to those program requirements for you.
I started toward the door, but just before I reached for the doorknob, I turned.
Mrs. Tate, have things changed much? I asked. I mean, are people different now?
I didn't know what I hoped her answer would be.
Yes, everyone learned their lesson, and now we're all one big happy family, just like they say we are in the newspapers. Or, no, there were no bullies. It was all in your head, just like they say. Nick was crazy, and you bought it, and that's all there was to it. You were angry for no reason. So angry. But it was all in your imagination.
Mrs. Tate chewed on her bottom lip and seemed to really consider the question.
People are people, she finally said, turning up her palms in a helpless, sad shrug. I think that was the last answer I wanted to hear.
May 2nd, 2008, 7:10 a.m. She might cast a spell on you, Christy.
Most days, I found it totally ironic that Mom drove Frankie to school because he hated to ride the bus, while I rode the bus because I hated the excruciating car ride with Mom. But some days, I wished I'd gone ahead and braved Mom's morning critiques because the bus was just such crap. Usually, I could crawl into a seat somewhere in the middle, sink down into a C-shape, my knees propped against the seat in front of me, listen to my MP3 player, and completely disappear. But lately, Christy Bruder had been a real pain. It's not like that was news, since I couldn't stand Christy anyway. Never could. Christy was one of those girls who was popular because most everyone was afraid not to be her friend. She was big and bulky, and had a gut that stood out belligerently in front of her, and thighs that were enormous and could crack a skull. Which was weird because she was the captain of the softball team. I never could figure that one out. I just couldn't imagine Christy Bruder outrunning anyone to first base. But she must have done it at least once or twice, I guess. Or maybe the coach was too afraid to cut her. Who knows? I'd known Christy since at least kindergarten, and never once had I thought I might like her. And vice versa. Every back-to-school night, my mom would pull the teacher aside and advise her that Christy and I should never sit at the same table group together.
We all have that one person, Mom would say to the teacher with an apologetic smile.
Christy Bruder was my one person. In elementary school, Christy called me Bucky Beaver. In sixth grade, she started a rumor that I wore a thong, which in middle school was a huge deal. And in high school, she decided she didn't like my makeup and clothes, and so started the nickname Sister Death that everyone thought was hilarious. She got on two stops after me,
which could work in my favor on most days because I had time to get invisible before she got on the bus. Not that I was afraid of her or anything. I just got sick of dealing with her. I sank into my seat, slid down where my head was barely peeking over the top of the backrest, and stuffed my earbuds into my ears, turning up the volume on my MP3 player with my thumb. I peered out the window, thinking that it would feel good to hold Nick's hand today. I could hardly wait to get to school and see him. I couldn't wait to smell the cinnamon gum on his breath and fold my head into the curl of his arm during lunch, sit shielded by him, all the rest of the world shut out. Christy Bruder, Jeremy, Mom and Dad and their discussions that always, always, always turned into screaming matches and ended with Dad slithering out of the house into a pocket of darkness, Mom sniffling pathetically in her room. The bus slid to a stop, and then to another. I kept my eyes glued to the window, looking out at a terrier nosing through a trash bag in front of a house. The terrier's tail was beating the wind, and his head was all but completely covered by the trash bag. I wondered how he could breathe, and tried to think of the things he might have found in there that would get him so excited. The bus got going again, and I turned up my MP3 player as the noise ratcheted up exponentially with the number of kids that got on. I leaned my head back against the seat and closed my eyes. I felt a bump against my arm. I figured it was somebody walking past and ignored it. Then I felt a harder one, and someone used the cord to snatch the earbud out of my right ear. It dangled in midair, tinny music spilling out of it. "What the hell?" I said, pulling the bud out of my left ear and rewinding the cord around the MP3 player. I looked to my right, and there was Christy Bruder's face grinning on the other side of the aisle. "Go away, Christy." Her ugly friend Ellen, the equally Amazonian, red-haired, man-faced Garvin varsity softball team catcher, laughed, but Christy just stared at me with this fake, innocent bat of her eyes.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Sister Death. Maybe you're having a hallucination. Maybe you got some bad ex or something. Maybe the devil did it."
I rolled my eyes. "Whatever." I pushed the earbuds back into my ears and settled back to my C-shape, closing my eyes. I wasn't going to give her the satisfaction of fighting back. Just as the bus turned into the Garvin driveway, I felt another shove against my shoulder. Only this time, there was a mighty yank on the cord of my earbuds, and they were ripped out of my ears so hard, the whole MP3 player flew out of my hand and skittered across the bus floor, settling under the seat ahead of mine. I picked it up. The green light on the side of it had blinked off, and the screen was blank. I flipped the switch to turn it off, and then on again. But nothing. It was dead.
"God, what is your problem?" I asked, my voice getting loud.
Again, Ellen was snickering her man face off, and so were a couple of other cronies sitting behind them. And again, Christy was giving me this fake wide-eyed look. The bus doors opened, and we all stood up. That's some sort of kid instinct, I think. You could be in the middle of just about anything, and if the bus doors opened, you stood up. It was one of the constants of life. You are born, you die, you stand up when the bus doors open. Christy and I stood up within inches of each other. I could smell pancake syrup on her. She sneered at me, giving me a slow top-to-bottom look.
"In a hurry to get to a funeral? Maybe dump Nick for a nice cold corpse? Oh wait, Nick is a corpse."
I held eye contact with her, refusing to back down. After all these years, she still hadn't tired of the same old stupid jokes, still hadn't grown out of them. Mom had told me once that if I kept ignoring Christy, eventually it would get boring for her. But on days like today, ignoring her was easier said than done. I was so over this rivalry thing, but no way was I going to let her get away with breaking my stuff. I pushed past her into the aisle, which had started moving.
"Whatever your problem is," I said. I held up my MP3 player. "You're going to pay for this." "Oh, I'm shaking in my boots," she said.
Someone else said,
"She might cast a spell on you, Christy."
And they all laughed.
I moved down the aisle and stepped down onto the sidewalk, cut behind the bus, and jogged to the bleachers where Stacy, Deuce, and David were hanging out as usual. I climbed up to meet them, out of breath and furious.
"Hey," Stacy said. "What's up? You look pissed."
"Yeah," I said. "Look what that bitch Christy Bruder did to my MP3 player."
"Oh, man,"
David said, taking it out of my hands. He pushed a few buttons, tried to switch it on and off a few times.
"You could get it fixed or something."
"I don't want to get it fixed," I said. "I want to kill her. God, I could just rip her stupid head off. She'll regret this. I'm totally going to get her back for this."
"Just blow her off," Stacy said. "She's such a cow. Nobody actually likes her."
A black Camaro roared into the parking lot and rolled up next to the football field. I recognized the car as Jeremy's, and my heart sped up. For a second, I forgot about the MP3 player. The passenger side door opened, and Nick stepped out. He had on the heavy black jacket he'd been wearing lately, and it was zipped up to his chin against the cool wind. I skipped up to the top of the bleachers and yelled out to him, "Nick!" I called, waving. He caught my motion, tipped his chin upward slightly, and shifted his course in my direction. He moved slowly, methodically, toward me. I bounded down the bleachers and across the lawn to him.
"Hey, baby,"
I said, reaching him and wrapping myself around him. He sort of dodged me, but leaned down and kissed me, then turned me and slung his arm across my shoulders, just like always. It felt so good to be under his arm again.
"Hey," he said, "what are you losers doing?"
He used his free hand to do some sort of handshake thing with Deuce, and then socked David in the shoulder.
"Where you been?"
David asked. Nick smirked, and I was struck by how odd he looked. Vibrant, almost buzzing or something.
"Been busy,"
was Nick's only reply. His eyes swept the front of the school.
"Been busy,"
he repeated. But he said it so quietly, I'm pretty sure I was the only one to hear him. Not that he was really talking to any of us. I could have sworn he was talking to the school itself. The building. The ant-like activity inside of it. Mr. Angerson scuffed up behind us then, and used his principal voice, the one we like to imitate at parties.
"No, Garvin students. Beer is bad for your growing brains. You must eat a healthy breakfast before coming to school, Garvin students. And remember, Garvin students, just say no to drugs."
"All right, Garvin students," he said.
Stacy and I elbowed each other and snickered.
"Let's not linger this morning. Time to go to class."
Deuce flicked Angerson a salute and started marching into the school. Stacy and David followed him, laughing. I started too, but stopped under Nick's arm, which was still holding me in place on the sidewalk. I looked up at him. He was still staring at the school, a grin playing around the corners of his mouth. "Better go before Angerson ruptures something," I said, tugging at Nick's arm. "Hey, I was thinking, want to ditch lunch and get Casey's today?" He didn't answer, but continued staring at the school silently. "Nick, we better go," I said again. No response. Finally, I kind of shoved him with my hip. "Nick?" He blinked and looked down at me, the grin never changing, the bright look in his eyes never wavering, maybe even growing more intense. I wondered what in the heck he and Jeremy had taken that morning. He was acting really weird.
"Yeah,"
he said.
"Yeah, got a lot to do today."
We started walking, our hips bumping one another with each step. "I'd let you borrow my MP3 player for first period, but Christy Bruder busted it on the bus," I said, holding it up for him to see. He peered at it for a moment. His smile widened. He grabbed me tighter and walked toward the door more quickly.
"I've been wanting to do something about her for a long time," he said.
"I know. I totally hate her," I whined, squeezing all the attention I could out of the incident. "I don't know what her problem is."
"I'll take care of it."
I smiled, excited. The sleeve of Nick's jacket scratched along the back of my neck. It felt nice, real, somehow. Like, as long as that sleeve was scratching along the skin of my neck, everything would be normal, even if he was on something. For right now, anyway, Nick was here with me, holding me, going to stand up for me. Not for Jeremy. For me. We hit the doors, and Nick finally let go of my shoulders. A breeze gusted right at that moment and swept down the collar of my shirt, billowing the front of it. I shuddered, my spine suddenly getting really cold. Nick opened a door and waited for me to go in ahead of him.
"Let's go get this finished," he said.
I nodded, heading toward the commons, my eyes peeled for Christy Bruder, my teeth chattering. Chapter 3. From the Garvin County Sun Tribune, May 3, 2008. Reporter, Angela Dash. Jeff Hicks, 15. As a freshman, Hicks would have ordinarily not been walking through the commons, according to some students.
"We don't go through there if we can help it," freshman Marcy Stindler told reporters. "The seniors hassle us if we go down there. It's sort of like an unwritten freshman rule to stay away from the commons, except during lunch. Every incoming freshman knows that."
But Hicks was running late on the morning of May 2nd and cut through the commons in his hurry to get to class, which some are calling a classic case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. He suffered a shot to the back of the head and died instantly at the scene. A memorial has been set up in his name at Garvin County State Bank. Police say it's unclear whether Leavell knew Hicks or if Hicks was accidentally hit by a bullet intended for someone else.
Because Mrs. Tate had kept me in her office for so long, I missed the first period bell and walked in right in the middle of Mrs. Tenniel's first day of school speech. I know Tate had done it to keep me from having to brave the pre-first period hallways, but I almost would have preferred that to the eyes boring into me when I walked into class. At least in the hallways, I could sort of walk in the shadows. I opened the door, and I swear the entire class stopped what they were doing and looked up at me. Billy Jenkins dropped his pencil and just let it roll off his desk. Mandy Horn's mouth flopped open so hard, I thought I heard her jaw crack. Even Mrs. Tenniel stopped talking and stood motionless for a few seconds. I stood in the doorway, wondering if it would really be all that noticeable if I just turned around and walked out of the classroom, out of the school, back home to bed. Tell Mom and Dr. Heeler that I was wrong, that I wanted to finish high school with a tutor after all, that I wasn't as strong as I originally thought. Mrs. Tenniel cleared her throat and put down the marker she was using on the whiteboard. I took a deep breath and shuffled to her desk, holding out the hall pass Mrs. Tate's secretary had given me on the way out.
"We are just going over this year's syllabus,"
Mrs. Tenniel said, taking the pass. Her face remained stone-like.
"Go ahead and take your seat. If you have any questions on something we've already covered, you can ask me after the bell."
I stared at her for a beat longer. Mrs. Tenniel had hardly been one of my fans to begin with. She always had a problem with the fact that I wouldn't participate in labs, and with the fact that Nick sort of accidentally set fire to a test tube in third period once. I can't even count how many times she'd landed Nick's butt in detention, and she'd always glared at me when I loitered on the sidewalk in front of the school, waiting for him to get out. I couldn't imagine what she must feel for me now. Pity, maybe, for not seeing in Nick what she always saw. Did she want to shake me and shout, "I told you so, you stupid girl!" Or maybe she felt loathing for what happened with Mr. Klein. Maybe she, like me, replayed that scene over and over in her head a million times a day. Mr. Klein, the chemistry teacher, using his body to literally shield about a dozen students. He was crying, snot running out of his nose, body shaking. He had his arms held out to each side, Christ-like, and was shaking his head at Nick, defiant and scared. I liked Klein. Everybody liked Klein. Klein was the kind of guy who'd come to your graduation party, the kind of guy who'd stop and talk to you in the mall, and none of that, "Hello, youngster," Mr. Angerson, the principal kind of crap either. Klein would say, "Hey, what's up? Keeping your nose clean?" Klein would turn a blind eye if he saw you sneak a beer at a restaurant and get away with it. Klein would give his life for you. We always kind of knew that about Klein. Now the whole world knew that about him. Thanks to impressive TV coverage of the shooting and that annoying Angela Dash writing for the Sun Tribune, pretty much everyone in the world knew that Mr. Klein had died because he wouldn't tell Nick where Mrs. Tennille was. So I suppose it wasn't news to Mrs. Tennille. I also suppose that's why she looked at me like I was a plague set free in her classroom. I turned and scuffed to an empty chair. I tried to keep my eyes rooted solely to the chair, but found it was impossible. I swallowed. My throat felt too thick. My hands were so sweaty my notebook was slipping out. My leg throbbed, and I felt myself limping and silently cursed myself for doing it. I curled into my desk and looked up at Mrs. Tennille. She stared at me until I was settled, and then turned back to the whiteboard, clearing her throat again and finishing writing her email address on the board. Slowly, the heads of my classmates turned back toward the front of the room, and I felt myself begin to breathe once again. 83, I chanted in my head. 82, if you don't count today. While Tennille talked about the best ways to contact her, I concentrated on my hands, trying to slow my breathing the way Dr. Healer had taught me to do. I stared at my nails, which were chipped and ugly. I'd never found the energy to file them smooth, and now I was oddly self-conscious about them. All the other girls would have prepared for the first day of school by doing things like painting their nails, picking out their best clothes. I'd barely even washed. It was just another way that I was different from all of them, and somehow, oddly, it was just another way that I was different from the way I used to be. I tucked my nails into my palms. I didn't want them to show, afraid that someone would notice how ugly they were, but found myself strangely calmed by the feeling of them jabbing jaggedly into my palms. I lowered my hands to my lap and made hard fists, squeezing until the nails dug into my palms, and I could take a breath without a wave of nausea rolling over me.
"Email me anytime you have a question," Mrs. Tennille was saying, pointing to what she'd written on the board, and then she stopped short. There was some commotion going on to my left. The kids were rustling around, one girl stuffing books and papers into her backpack quickly. Tears were streaking down her face, and she was hiccuping, trying to keep it inside. A few other girls were hovering over her, rubbing her back and talking to her.
"Is there a problem?" Mrs. Tennille asked. "Kelsey? Megan? Is there a reason you're not in your chairs?"
"It's Ginny," Megan said, pointing at the crying girl, who I now realized was Ginny Baker. I'd heard on the news about all the plastic surgery she'd had, but hadn't really realized how much it had changed her face until now. Mrs. Tennille placed the dry erase marker into the tray at the bottom of the board, then quietly and steadily folded her hands in front of her.
"Ginny,"
she said, in a voice so soft, I wasn't sure at first it had come out of Tennille.
"Is there something I can do to help?
Do you need to go get a drink, maybe?"
Ginny zipped her backpack and stood. Her whole body was shaking.
"It's her,"
she said, without moving. Everyone knew who she was talking about, though, and they all turned to look at me. Even Tennille glanced in my direction. I put my face back down toward my hands and squeezed my fingernails into my palms even harder. I sucked my lips inside my mouth and bit down on them hard from the inside, clamping them shut.
"I can't sit here with her without thinking about...
She sucked in a breath, and then let it out with a stream of anguish that made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
"Why did they let her come back?"
She grabbed her backpack with both hands in front of her, hugged it to her belly, and rushed up the aisle, pushing both Megan and Kelsey backward into desks. Mrs. Tennille took a couple steps toward her and stopped. She nodded slightly, and Ginny rushed out of the room, her contorted and ragged face pulled up into a grimace. Everything was completely still for a minute, and I squeezed my eyes shut and silently counted backward from 50, another one of those coping methods I'd learned from Mom or Dr. Healer, I couldn't remember. I heard bells in my ears, and I felt twitchy. Should I leave too? Go after Ginny, tell her I'm sorry? Go home and never come back? Should I say something to the class? What do I do? Finally, Mrs. Tennille cleared her throat again, turned back to the whiteboard, and picked up her marker. Her face looked unsettled, but her manner remained stoic. Good old steady Tennille. Couldn't charm her nor faze her.
"As I was saying," she began,
and then she launched back into her lecture. I blinked away the little white lights that were dancing in front of my eyes and tried to focus on what she was saying, which was hard because pretty much nobody stopped staring at me.
"The next unit will focus on..."
There was more restlessness, and once again she turned and stopped. I glanced to my left and saw a couple kids talking heatedly among each other.
"Class?"
Mrs. Tennille said, her voice still stern but losing its grip on authoritative.
"May I have your attention now, please?"